Shrink Wrap Radio number 58, Understanding Art Therapy, November 3rd, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Because we've verbalized it all, we think that we can use our cognitive capacities to solve the problem. But the problem's bigger than that. How does the person's heart feel? You know, what's the trauma that's happened? The current definition for trauma is speechless terror. If you have speechless terror, how are you really going to language through to healing some traumatic experience? Whether it's incest experience or a car accident, Katrina, 9/11, those kinds of things. They really go into our human bodies and they stay there.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Suzanne Lovell, who for a number of years has been the program coordinator for the master's degree program in art therapy at Sonoma State University. After earning her own master's degree at Sonoma State, Dr. Lovell went on to earn her PhD at the Union Institute. In addition to the PhD, she also is a board-certified art therapist, and every other year she also spends some weeks teaching in an art therapy program in Bern, Switzerland. In addition to her extensive teaching, program administration, and clinical work, Dr. Lovell has also authored chapters in two books on the subject. I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Lovell in the home office of her country home outside Santa Rosa, California. Here's the interview. Dr. Suzanne Lovell, thanks so much for agreeing to be my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, well, let's start out by having you talk a bit about what art therapy is and is not.
Ooh, that's going to take a long time, but I'll try to make it as brief as possible.
Okay.
Art therapy is the use of art materials, imagination, and creativity to help people express what they really think, believe, feel, and what they intuit.
Okay. And what is it not? I mean, are there misconceptions that people have about art therapy where you feel like you need to say, well, it's not about...
Well, our culture thinks that doing art is very... is a weird thing to do. In other words, when we're children, it's very natural for us to do art. We do it in grammar school, we do it at home, we enjoy making it very much. By the time we get into high school, or certainly by the time we graduate, then it's really not okay to do art because, for one thing, you don't think of yourself as an artist. There's a big prejudice in our country about art and artists in that sense.
Well, to what extent does one have to be an artist to be an art therapist?
That raises a really big question.
Okay.
Again, I think our culture is prejudiced against the notion of art making. The best source I know about art as what it is and how it works comes from a very interesting book by a woman by the name of Ellen Dissanayake called Homo Aestheticus. And she believes that we are all, you know, naturally born artists, that it's part of our heritage. And it's really only in the recent era, particularly in this country, that the notion of being an artist has been relegated over to a fringe group and a lot of prejudices about those fringe groups, like they're weird people or they're, you know, they're into drugs, they're into alcohol, they're out of the mainstream of what it is. What she says is that art is making special. And to me, that's the best definition about art that I've ever come upon. So anytime we're making special, we're doing art.
Okay. And I guess part of the prejudice that you're talking about is when we're kids in school, there are negative influences, negative messages that many of us have gotten in school,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Such as, oh, that looks stupid. It just takes two or three people to say to a child, oh, that looks stupid, yeah. even from among his peers.
Right.
And he or she's going to withdraw from doing art because there's the verdict.
Or I can remember being a child and looking over at some other child's artwork, and their horse looked like a horse.
Yes.
So I immediately was self-condemning, I think, without yeah. anybody else coming and giving me a negative message. I gave myself one.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's one of the things that happens that, what, that we need to overcome?
Well, it's pervasive in the school system, and I think that's a larger issue that we can't address here.
Okay.
But the loss of art, for children not to be able to make a lot of art through all their years of schooling, mm-hmm. really, I think, has a negative effect on how they turn out in terms of their socialization, mm-hmm. in terms of how they use their mind, certainly in terms of their sensory awareness of their environment. The arts speak to all of those issues.
Mm-hmm. And in this country, at least, funding for art in school has dried up considerably.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. So how old a field is art therapy? Can you trace its historical roots at all?
Well, the creation of a profession in America started in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. It started before that in England, and it was based on folks working in hospitals and doing art and seeing how what a difference it made, mm-hmm. and then gradually forming it into a profession.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what are the theoretical underpinnings of your work in art therapy?
Ooh. The good news is that you can be any kind of a psychologist you want as an art therapist.
So you could subscribe to any theory that you could be a Freudian or a Jungian or a Rogerian or...
Or behavior cognitive.
Really?
Oh, yes, that's used a lot today with good results.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me push you a little harder, though. What's your theoretical outlook when you work as
an
art therapist?
Certainly I have the psychology background that mm-hmm. I need mm-hmm. to work clinically. But my interest and my passion has to do with what's called indigenous mind. What is it that we know inherently? Indigenous means at home within ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I've studied a lot of other cultures and their art making, as well, of course, as what's happening here in the United States. And I'm stunned over and over by the human capacity in times of stress or in times of great joy to turn to art to express it. Mm-hmm. It's a very natural process that we all do. I've worked in locked wards, and the people were very anxious to make art and express themselves in such deep-hearted mm-hmm. ways mm-hmm. that sometimes I had to question who was more crazy, the patients mm-hmm. or their keepers.
Yeah, yeah. What about the Jungian perspective? I would have been under the impression that that might have influenced your thinking a lot.
It did, insofar that Jung talked about symbolic healing. And so there's a whole theory that Jung created, and certainly his followers also, mm-hmm. about the importance of art making as a healing process.
Right.
And also as healing, meaning making whole. And that's so individual for every person.
That really gets at my next question, which is, what is it about the process of art making that you believe is therapeutic?
Whoa, all of it. You know, the fact that there's someone sitting beside you, not across from you, but beside you,
okay.
looking at the art-making process, it's like you're both on the journey together.
Mm.
So there's that piece.
Okay.
And then the fact that there's all these kinds of materials to choose from, that a person can go to what interests them, what attracts them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and an art therapist trusts that process. We completely trust all the aspects of the process. So somebody goes, a little boy goes and gets some clay and he starts doing things with it. And I'm there to help him. What is it you want to do with the clay?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, I want to make a castle, but I don't know how to put a door in. And so then I help him learn how to put a door in.
Mm.
In that process, he's actually problem solving, not just how to make a castle. He's problem solving how to do his life.
In what way?
His thoughts, his feelings, his behaviors. He's having a good positive experience, and it begins to change how he can behave in the classroom.
Okay, and putting a door in might also have some symbolic significance in his life, right?
Absolutely.
In terms of what, keeping people out or letting people in or keeping himself safe.
all those things. Mm-hmm. Whatever the patient comes up with, I take very seriously as their nonverbal or metaverbal, beyond words, okay. Metaverbal statement about this is true for me. Mm-hmm. And when they show me what's true, then I can come in and say, well, let's help you deal with that. And if it means then bringing in the parents at a different time and working with the parents, or if it has to do with a boss and a secretary, or, I mean, siblings, it can work with everybody. Mm-hmm. That's the best news. Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting a picture from what you've said of what an art therapist's office or workspace might look like. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there would be a variety of materials. Yes. You mentioned clay.
Yes.
What other materials
clay,
might we see?
Clay, paints, oil pastels, chalk pastels, papers in all different colors and all different sizes, small pieces of paper when someone wants to really protect themselves, like a 9x12 piece of paper, 18x24 we often work at. We also have rolls of paper. We can unroll, you know, 40 feet of paper if they need it.
Yeah.
Soft papers, hard papers.
Okay.
And plus all kinds of, this is another thing why I think art therapists become art therapists. They love stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you got, fabrics, for example?
Fabrics, scissors.
Tactile things.
Yes. My hands are going back.
Yes, right.
All kinds of tactile things, which is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. And then part of the picture that I have that I want to underscore, as you said, that as an art therapist, you would sit beside the person rather than
across.
And that's to indicate that you're going on the journey with them, that
yes.
you're there as a collaborator.
Yes.
Rather than as
yes.
a judge or...
Or even the way, I mean, children versus their parents, you know, or a person versus their boss. I mean, mm-hmm. when that encounter comes in that way, it can be very intimidating.
Yeah.
But they don't really see me. They just know that I'm this energy here that's mm-hmm. really encouraging them and supporting them. Whether they're 9 years old or they're 46 years old. Or
okay.
The oldest person I work with is 98 years old.
So this is not just for children, then?
No, this is for everybody.
Okay, well, let me play devil's advocate a
sure.
bit. People always love that. We have counselors and psychologists and social workers and psychiatrists and hypnotherapists and marriage family therapists and on and on. What do we need with art therapists?
Well, last week I gave a 2-hour presentation in a family services agency kind of place, all
okay.
right? And they have probably 25 counselors there. They're all working industriously with clients and mm-hmm. families. And he had me come in because we have an intern there, and she was being very frustrated because she couldn't get people to understand what art therapy was. So...
He being the director
yes,
of this
director.
Program?
Thank
okay.
you, the director. So we start with this meeting, and I have several people tell me very confidently, oh, I do art therapy with my clients, and I do art therapy with my clients. You know, they're all mm-hmm. talking about the art therapy that they do with their clients, and I say, well, let's talk about that. And so at the end of the 2-hour period and showing slides and how an art therapist actually works with people,
okay.
it was like it was radically different. And it was educational for the whole agency. And the director called me the following day and said he was so excited, and everyone there was so excited, they're now going to make an art room, they're going to bring in all kinds of supplies, and they're going to support the internship program.
Oh, that sounds great.
So they really learned that art speaks to a different part of the person. Mm-hmm. We have so many defenses that we've learned to use that prevent us from healing and solving our problems. And art can go underneath those things.
Yes, yeah. The fact that it's nonverbal, I guess, is a big piece of that.
Yes.
Yeah. So I can imagine someone being in distress and deciding that they need psychotherapy, but I have a little bit more trouble envisioning someone saying to themselves, I really need to get myself into art therapy.
Well, you know, we're still the new kid on the block,
even
though we're the oldest therapy in a way. Because people were making art thousands of years ago on the walls and on
yeah.
the ceilings to express their beliefs, their hopes, their fears. It's no different today. People want to do the same thing. But because we've verbalized it all, we think that we can use our cognitive capacities to solve the problem. But the problem's bigger than that. How does the person's heart feel? You know, what's the trauma that's happened?
Mm-hmm.
The current definition for trauma is speechless terror. If you have speechless terror, how are you really going to language through to healing some traumatic experience? Whether it's incest experience or a car accident, Katrina, 9/11, those kinds of things. They really go into our human bodies and they stay there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like the way you put that. That kind of leads into my next question of whether or not there are diagnoses or life issues for which art therapy is either indicated or contraindicated. And you've just given me a hint saying that trauma situations would be one place maybe where it really is indicated as a good approach. Are there other?
I think it's indicated for everything.
For everything.
That may sound too bold. But we, as children, we instinctively turn and make art. We make things. It's natural. We go out in our backyard and we'll play with the mud and we'll make things. It's indigenous to us. It's mm-hmm. genetically encoded mm-hmm. for us to be curious about materials and to work with them. And in art therapy, you work with those materials and you feel better because not only have you released it from the psychosomatic aspect, but cognitively you have a new understanding about whatever the dynamics are that are going on.
Okay.
And obviously that means the art therapist is able to talk with the person about those dynamics.
Yes. I in the process of being an interviewer, sometimes I see my job as playing dumb so that mm-hmm. the interviewee can be drawn out. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, I've used some of these processes in my teaching over mm-hmm. the years in mm-hmm. Myth, Dream, Symbol. And it's always wonderful when we do something like collage and the students are, and in a way it's, an outsider might come in and say, oh, this looks like kindergarten, you know, and it almost takes us back to kindergarten, mm-hmm. and people might have a judgment that, well, this can't be of any value. But it's so powerful to see how people go inward, mm-hmm. and they get very busy and involved in cutting out and pasting or doing whatever the art process is. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's terribly evocative. A lot of material comes up.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is another really salient reason why art therapy is so important mm-hmm. and should be part of the therapeutic team. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a case history example or two from your own work? Maybe describing some art therapy processes that you've done? For example, you were hoping to show me a slideshow, and I sort of vetoed it because the slide projector would make too much noise on the audio tape and people wouldn't be able to see it. But you were telling me about a little boy that you worked with, and maybe you could describe that series a bit.
The little boy was brought in because he was so disruptive in kindergarten that he couldn't stay in school.
Oh, we should give him Ritalin then.
Right, that's what they would do today.
Yeah.
His family was a lovely family, professional, educated, a mother, teacher, father, working for the city that I was working in. And they didn't know what to do with him. So I began to work with him by inviting him to go to the materials that interested him. And he mm-hmm. started out with felt pens.
Okay.
Smelly markers is something that children love to use. And he drew me a castle. And it was a wonderful castle. The castle had a door on it, had a little knight on the side of it with his little shield and his sword. And he was very happy, and he put a lot of energy into that castle. Mm-hmm. So that by the end of the session, he had really changed already. He'd quieted it down. He was calmer. Mm-hmm. He left calmer. Mm-hmm. And I heard a week later when he came back, his mother said, something happened for him. Hmm. He was calmer. Now, that didn't solve the problem.
Yeah.
It took took 4.5 months and doing therapy with him. We worked with the castle theme because that's what he wanted to do.
Okay.
All I had to do was to help him. We did it with clay. We did it with sticks. We did it with colors. Eventually, he had shifted enough the energy inside of him that he was completely at peace with everybody, and his final art object was a clay house in which everybody had their own house, their own window, with their ability to close the windows by putting something in front of the windows. So what it meant for him was that he had finally gotten some privacy and mm-hmm. some acceptance for who he was and how he was, and it took off the stress for him of trying to be more grown up than he was at 5 years old.
And did this translate into the school situation as
yes,
well?
Yes. The reports back were this kid went sailing from then on.
Okay. And did that castle evolve over time?
Yes, the castle evolved from being just something on paper to he made 4 or 5 different castles using clay and sticks. And each time he was working out another part of that interior experience that when he could put out there, it relieved him. And he continued to relieve himself over that period of time that we worked, and his behavior changed automatically and in a very beautiful way.
And how much, if any, interpretation did you do in that process? Are you saying, oh, no, this represents how closed off you're feeling? Or
no, and I wouldn't do that with an adult either.
Okay.
Because I don't think that interpretation is really as relevant as the actual direct experience that the person has. And that's really the beauty of art therapy. When you give a person choices with materials and they do their own direct experience in working with them and of making sense of them, then it's grounded inside of them.
You direct a master's level art therapy program. Can you give us a brief overview of how that program is structured?
It's a 3-year program.
Wow.
Most master's programs are 2 years, but we found that for art therapy, you really need 3 years, because during that time, you also have to be making your art.
And your own art.
Your own art, absolutely. And working with the other folks in your cohort, in your circle, making art and giving meaning to it. Mostly when people come into the program, they've come as artists who know studio art, and or they just love art and they want to become art therapists. So either way is fine, as long as they get their 15 units of studio art therapy in.
So they need to be getting into their own process while they're in this training.
Yes, throughout their education.
Kind of equivalent to psychoanalysts needing to be psychoanalyzed while they're in training.
Very much so. If you just have somebody do art and you have no idea about art making, you can do a big disservice.
Okay. And then are there then there must be other courses that they're taking, some cognitive components?
They do all of the coursework that's normally required for licensure. They have to have human development, so we have child art therapy, adolescent art therapy, adult art therapy, 2 semesters of family art therapy, in terms of populations, and then we have internships, practicum. They have to have supervision every 10 hours and complete 700 hours before they graduate. They have to have theories and principles and standards and ethics and whatever you would find in a regular licensable program.
Okay, so there's quite a bit. And what is the license that they're headed towards?
Well, at Sonoma State, they can't get a license. We're working toward hopefully having the LPC, which is the National Master's License, Licensed Professional Counselor, LPC.
Okay.
In California, you have to have an MFT to become a licensed professional.
Yeah, marriage family therapist.
Yes.
And there's another credential that you have called the ATR. What is that?
After I finished my master's and completed hundreds of hours, I got to become a registered art therapist, ATR. And then after that, I took an exam, a national exam, and became a certified art therapist. So it's an ATRBC, board certified.
Oh, okay, great, great. So there's always a growth path.
It's a profession.
Yeah,
it's probably the smallest one among the counseling field. But I think it's probably one of the most important ones because of its ancient origins and how it can help people with so many issues that are metaverbal, preverbal, nonverbal.
Yeah, and it's still, as you say, it's still kind of in its infancy in a way. If it started in the 60s, you're kind of one of the people who's pioneering its acceptance. What will your students do after they graduate? Are there jobs out there for them?
Throughout the United States, there's many jobs. In California, if they don't have the MFT, they are at a disadvantage at this time.
At this time.
Yeah. But they actually, where they work is everywhere. They work in day treatment centers, geriatric facilities, convalescent homes, schools, just about any place you could name.
Art therapist.
Absolutely. I have a person up in Oregon working with teenagers who have killed. And wow. The warden of that prison is just in love with this woman for the work she's doing with these young men who never had a chance in the first place and have killed people.
Wow. What's your advice to any listeners out there who might want to become art therapists themselves?
Do art. Make your art. Uh-huh. Find some friends and start making art, you know. Take art classes. Try to find teachers who are process-oriented. It's also good to know how to make things because you want to help somebody know how to make a figure, for example. But your enthusiasm and love of art making is really the basis of it.
What does that mean, try to find a teacher who's process-oriented?
Most art teachers today have gone through an education which makes them very finished product oriented because they want their students to go out and have shows of art, right? And sell and be professional artists. Well, to become a professional art therapist means you have to combine psychology and art making and you have to marry the two.
And it's the process of the art making that's important in the
Absolutely.
Therapy rather than what it actually looks like, you know, whether it's going to be saleable, for example.
Completely true. The process of art making is a recreative process. It stimulates the imagination. And imagination and creativity are really at the heart, not only of everybody's nature, but of those people who come in to do art therapy and they want to find a resolution to their problems.
Okay. Let me ask you, you know, aside from finding somebody that's nurturing like that, what about art therapy programs? There's yours. Are there others around the country, around the world?
Oh, yes, there are. Certainly throughout the United States.
Okay. Is there a good website that you would recommend for people who are interested in investigating this profession?
Sure. The American Art Therapy Association, which is the national group, has a website, www.arttherapy.org.
Okay, good. What about a book? If you could recommend one book, is there one that springs to mind?
Oh, there's so many. Well, the one I mentioned earlier about making special, Homo Aestheticus, is a really good book to help you to understand about art making, period. Then if you're interested, then there are books by Judith Rubin and Harriet Waitson, Sean McNiff. Sean McNiff is probably the first person to read. He really understands any of his books.
As we wrap things up, I'm wondering if there's anything more that you'd like to say about art therapy.
Art therapy starts with a scribble. And if you're willing to scribble and just look and see who's there, what's there, and draw it out and say, hello, who are you? And welcome that figure in or that scene in. Maybe it's a tree. We can talk to trees. You know, our ancestors talk to everything in nature, so we can still do that. Then I think you're on your way.
Very good. Suzanne Lovell, thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Suzanne Lovell. I wish you could see her. To me, she's always looked like a delightful pixie. And at the same time, when she speaks about her work, there's always such a sense of real depth and authenticity behind her words. This is an interview that has been long overdue. We chatted briefly after the interview, and she gave me a tour of the house she and her husband are building on their property. Actually, it will be sort of a family compound with three generations living together there. She's very excited about living with her children and grandchildren and spoke about it as a wonderful opportunity to explore what she calls, in our interview, indigenous mind in greater depth. I asked her if by indigenous mind she means what Buddhists call Buddha mind. She let me know that she's quite familiar with the Buddhist concept of empty mind or no mind, but that her use of indigenous mind is getting at something a bit different. She says indigenous mind is pre-religious. It predates the great world religions and goes back to the shamanic state of mind in which everything is alive. She describes it as pre-verbal or metaverbal, and that it's sensate-based and communicates through imagery. Actually, I'm kicking myself that I didn't get this part of our chat into the recording. This interview also brings up for me the thing I probably miss most about teaching, which is the sharing of creative projects in my class on myth, dream, and symbol, which I taught for so many years, both at Sonoma State University and for 2 years at the University of New Hampshire. I can't take credit for originating the idea of the creative project assignment. It's one I was inspired to steal from some of my colleagues. I suppose it springs from our shared belief that the deepest learning is not only cognitive, but also emotional. So we seek assignments and exercises that will engage students not only intellectually, but also emotionally, that will engage not only their conscious minds, but also their unconscious. The most direct route to the affective and the unconscious tends to be nonverbal. Consequently, the assignment was that every student would be required to present a creative project during the final days of the semester. Typically, this was to be something that they would create with their hands that would represent something from their dream lives over the semester. I would emphasize that this creative project assignment would be ungraded but absolutely required, and that they would be presenting it to the entire class. Now, some students initially find this assignment very foreign and distressing. They know how to read a book, how to memorize and prepare for an exam, but some are absolutely flummoxed by such a wide-open assignment as this. I've actually had a few students over the years come to me in tears, protesting that they just aren't creative and they can't do it. Ultimately, though, they all came through. I emphasize to students that the artistic merit of their project is not what is important. What is important is that they produce something that reflects their own inner process. Sometimes I'll do a creative project myself, and all the same fears will come up for me that the students wrestle with. Oh, I can't do this. I'm not an artist. It will look stupid, and on and on. The interesting thing is that when we press past these resistances, the final project most often does have some artistic merit. I end up treasuring the things that I've produced, and I'm blown away by the things most of my students have produced, especially those who swore they didn't have an artistic bone in their body. I have a wonderful slide collection of creative projects produced over the years. I wish I could share them with you. Of paintings and drawings, collages, masks, weavings, jewelry, mysteriously decorated boxes, puppets, clay figures, and a wide variety of magical constructions that defy description. In the final days of class, each student gets about 10 to 15 minutes to present their project, to talk about what the process was like for them, and what the final product means for them. Finally, they're asked to give the project a voice, that is, to imagine that it can speak and to complete a sentence that starts with, "I am." So, for example, a student might hold up a mask they've made and say something like, "I am the dark and powerful side that is just now willing to come forth." Or another might hold up a painting and say something along the lines of, "I'm the lonely little girl who is reaching out to others." Then the object is passed around the circle, and each person in the circle makes an I statement as their own way of receiving and commenting on that creative project. This process of sharing in the circle is very powerful, revealing, and moving. Tears of joy or compassion are not unusual. And it's the facilitation of that sort of experience, dear listener, that I miss most about teaching. On the other hand, I have this new class, my largest one yet, here with you.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Thanks so much to each of you who has taken our listener survey. Right now we have 35 completed surveys, which include a lot of valuable feedback and suggestions. At the very end of the survey, you have the option to include your name and email address, and as an added incentive to get you all to fill out the survey, for everyone who completes it and includes their name and email address, you'll automatically get back a link to some exclusive content. Some years back, I gave a talk on dreams at the University of New Hampshire, and you'll get access to that talk. So if you'd like to get this special feature, just go to our survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm, or you can also find a link on our website. And as all you psychology majors probably know, we need to get at least 100 completed surveys back before they become statistically meaningful. So if you're listening in your car or you're on a walk, please remember to do it first thing when you get back home. It only takes about 3 minutes. Meanwhile, our Frapper map has grown to 244 pins, of which we have 7 new additions to our Frapper map. And I want to give a big thank you and a welcome to Tom in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Susie in Vancouver, British Columbia, Kevin in Schenectady, New York, Nate in San Francisco, Larisse in the Netherlands, Annika right here in Rohnert Park where I am, and Eric in Mount Dora, Florida. To add yourself to our growing Frapper map, all you have to do is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. Now, Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R. But you'll also find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com, and that makes it even easier. Plus, you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book I co-authored. Sometime in the not-too-distant future, the Shrink Wrap Radio website will have a new look and feel, thanks to listener John Denwood, who's taken on this project. And he keeps urging me to add a blog and a discussion forum. If I move in those directions, I'm going to need some volunteer help from one or two people who have the time, some experience with these modalities, and reasonable familiarity with the field of psychology to serve as moderators and perhaps contributors. So please let me know if you're interested. Right now, I feel like I've got my hands full just producing the podcast, and a blog and a forum seem like those might be the straws that break the camel's back, so to speak. So I could use some volunteer help. Speaking of website development, don't forget you can get great discounts on a whole range of web services at GoDaddy.com by using either Shrink1, Shrink2, or Shrink3 on checkout. Find more info about this on our website. I've been asking you to subscribe to Shrink Wrap Radio if you don't already do so, and I've suggested you could use iTunes, Podshow, or Juice, among others. However, some people might think that you have to divulge personal information or pay money to subscribe, since that's what the word subscription often entails. Let me emphasize that subscribing costs no money, and you don't have to divulge any personal information. It simply means that the latest episodes will show up automatically in your podcatcher of choice, whether it be iTunes, Podshow, Juice, Odeo, Yahoo, and so on. It means you get the shows automatically, and it means I can better track how many people are listening. If you're confused by this whole subscription idea and you need help, just send me an email and I'll walk you through it.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Since we're living dangerously, let's go to some listener emails. Actually, I just received an email from Suzanne Lovell, today's guest. In reality, the interview was conducted a few days ago. She sent me a 4-page bibliography on art therapy, so if you'd like a copy of her recommended reading list, send me a request via email, and I'll send it to you. Here's a bit of the sweet note from Suzanne that accompanied it. She writes, "I've always loved talking to strangers, despite my mother's warnings, because how they do their lives and what it means to them bring up some really amazing moments of being human. May your project grow well and bring many wonderful connections. I believe that you found a new profession that serves both the individual and the larger world. What better way to carry on humanistic psychology beyond the walls of the university? May blessings abound for you, Suzanne." Isn't that a great message to receive from a colleague? I wish that you all are so blessed as to have colleagues such as this. Next is a very thought-provoking email from Tom in Australia, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've just finished your entire back catalog and have greatly enjoyed all of them." Tom, I'm impressed and I'm very grateful to you. "Well done on the ever-increasing sound quality, especially. I will send you more extensive thoughts on your topics to date, but in the meantime, a comment on hypnotherapy. In your most recent show, you stated that someone under hypnosis cannot be made to do anything that they are not consciously capable of doing. Although I've not researched the field extensively, I believe this to be correct in the vast majority of instances. One notable exception, however, is the somatoform disorder, in which a patient experiences paralysis or some other extensive disability without any medically diagnosable cause. This is a very severe form of psychosomatic illness or disability. I'm a mature psychology student in Melbourne, Australia. Our course is strongly influenced by cognitive behavioral therapy. Indeed, Freud and Jung have only been mentioned a handful of times in the last 3 years, and rarely in a positive light. I will explore the philosophical questions this raises at a later date, but it is of interest in the context of this email because the gold standard explanation and treatment in Australian clinical practice for somatoform disorder is the psychoanalytical one. The hallmarks of somatoform disorder are a historical event or series of events that place huge, generally negative social pressures on the patient. The patient develops a somatoform disability, which deflects the responsibility or fallout from the event. The benefit to the patient is twofold. Firstly, they do not have to face the responsibility for the event, and secondly, they receive succor from friends, family, and medical staff as they become invalids. We were given an example of a teenager from a conservative family who was banned from seeing her boyfriend. Unbeknownst to the family, she snuck out one night to meet him. At that meeting, she was sexually assaulted. Very shortly afterwards, she became numb and paralyzed from the waist down, necessitating a wheelchair. As a result of her infirmity, she received the sympathy and support of her family in place of certain beration and possible excommunication. It appears that in many instances of somatoform disorder, the patient is not conscious to the underlying cause of their disability. In some instances, they are. This is a very important distinction in Australia particularly. If a patient is unconscious to the cause, then they're considered by our legal system to be genuinely disabled, and in the instance of industrial legal action, will receive compensation. If conscious, they are considered malingering and may be liable to pay damages. The real problem is that there is no reliable way of diagnosing conscious or unconscious awareness. Yes, and that was my point in an earlier podcast. He goes on, "Sorry for the very long tangent, but the point was that somatoform patients under hypnosis do not exhibit their symptoms. Indeed, the teenager from my example was videotaped dancing under hypnosis, something she did not believe herself capable of doing. It seems that somatoform disorder may be a dysfunction of suggestion, and that under the suggestion of hypnosis, the disorder can be overcome, if only temporarily. Keep up the great work, Tom." Tom, thanks for that very excellent note. In fact, you've described the very situation that gave birth to psychoanalysis. I believe the somatoform disorder you describe to be what in former times was called conversion hysteria. Hysterical blindness, anesthesias, and paralyses were rampant in Freud's time, and these played a large role in his formulation of unconscious motivation and also in his development of the free association technique. Originally, he used hypnosis to treat these unconscious symptoms, having been trained to do so by Charcot in France. Later, he abandoned hypnosis because he found it somewhat unreliable and unpredictable. After seeing a stage hypnosis demonstration of a post-hypnotic amnesia being broken by encouraging the subject to ramble on a bit, he developed his free association technique, encouraging his patients to lie on a couch and report whatever popped into consciousness without censorship. He found this more reliably broke the amnesias connected to the hysterical symptoms. And just as you describe in your case example, he found that these symptoms were generally brought on by various kinds of sexual traumas. Now, I believe you've misquoted me slightly. In your email, you write, "In your most recent show, you stated that someone under hypnosis cannot be made to do anything they are not consciously capable of doing." Actually, I think what I said, or at least what I meant, was that adequately motivated research subjects have been able to do all the dramatic feats that stage hypnotists typically use. And I think I also made a distinction between stage hypnosis and clinical hypnosis. I don't doubt the truth of the case you report. And you make a good point, I think, in pointing out that there are clinical situations where hypnosis does seem to give a fairly unique leverage. The whole question of whether people can be motivated to do things under hypnosis that they would not do in the waking state continues to be a thorny one, at least in terms of formal research into the issue. Unfortunately, there's often a gap between what can be demonstrated in research and what is experienced in the clinical situation. So, Tom, thanks again for your email, and I hope you'll keep those very sharp observations coming. And we got an email from Brad, who is a grad student at the University of North Texas, a grad student in psychology, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to stop by and say hello and that I enjoy your show. I listen to your podcast as I walk through campus. I look forward to each episode you post. I do have a request. Could you do a show with someone who specializes in schizophrenia research and theories of the development of the disorder? Thanks again, Brad." Hey, Brad, that's an excellent suggestion. I will definitely keep my eye out for that. I'm sure you know that there probably is no one single theory of schizophrenia. And there are a lot of different avenues that are being researched. And it's probably not just one disorder, but a collection of disorders. And that's about the extent of my knowledge on the subject, so I will look for an expert. Got a very nice email from Nir in New York City. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. "Dear Dr. Dave, I wanted to thank you for your inspiring podcast. I found it lately while searching for doing a search for Psychology MP3 and have been listening to it with great interest and pleasure. My name is Nir, and I live in New York. I have a master's degree in computer science and a bachelor degree in electrical engineering. I work as an automation engineer, and I'm also a professional musician, keyboard player." Oh, I'm jealous. I've been trying to learn the keyboard, and I'm afraid I'm coming to it pretty late in life. He goes on to say, "My wife is a PhD clinical psychologist, and being married to a psychologist has been a great challenge, causing me to become very interested in psychology myself. I have been in therapy for 3 years, and since then I've been reading many books and listening to many different spiritual and psychological teachings, many of which are mentioned in your programs. It's great to find such a podcast, and I sometimes wonder about the dates of the recordings. How long ago were they recorded, etc.? I would love to hear back from you, even if it's just an acknowledgement that you received my email. Keep up the good work, Nir." Well, I did respond by email, and now you get this double response by being read out over the air. And the programs are dated. I tell the date right at the beginning of the show. And as I mentioned in my email, I think these podcasts are mostly timeless. That is, I think they will be as hopefully as interesting and as relevant several years from now, maybe even longer, as they are today. At least that's my hope. And we hear once again from longtime listener and faithful writer Lloyd in Australia, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. After listening to your show on forgiveness, I would like to share my personal approach. I believe in an omnipotent, omniscient, good God. It follows for me that if God is omnipotent, he must be able to stop anything from happening that he chooses. Because he is omniscient, he knows about everything that happens. Therefore, all the bad things that have ever happened to me must have been personally okayed by God and thus actually be good. The badness of it is simply my error from the limited perspective of not being omniscient. Thus, I have nothing to forgive. It might be a little abstract for most people, but it's real to me. Best regards, Lloyd." I think I follow your reasoning there, Lloyd. As usual, very original turn of mind. And there are a few more emails, including a wonderful My Chingo message from Susie, but I think I'm going to wrap it up for today, and we'll get those other emails and that My Chingo message in the very next podcast.
Hi, this is Mike from Cape Town, South Africa, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks for that transition, Mike. Mike created that on My Chingo, and I would encourage others of you to do the same. You'll find a link to My Chingo. You'll see the logo for My Chingo right there on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And all you need is a microphone hooked up to your computer. It's absolutely free. It's great fun. You can also send your emails to me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. Please help us grow our audience by continuing to spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, to your fellow students, to your colleagues, to your professors. Thanks again to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Lovell, for the interview. And I want to let you know that my next guest will be a psychologist who works with the victims of torture. This is a difficult topic, but certainly an important one. You really shouldn't miss it. We close with a piece of PodSafe music, which seems particularly appropriate for our interview on art therapy with Dr. Lovell. It's called I Love Every Color by Matthew Ebel. And it's on the PodShow Music Network. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Don't forget to take our survey. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.